But good to have you back again. We have two handouts tonight, so if you didn't get two different sheets, make sure you pick one up on the way out. I'm not going to be referring to either one of these in the course of the lesson. They're just for you to have for additional reading in the course of the week. So you can see as you're looking at them that the one that's entitled Great Lessons from the Book of Job, the one that has much more information on it, is just an outstanding work that I found online looking at a wide variety of lessons that can be derived from that Book of Job. The other one is the bulletin article that you almost got this morning. Okay, so poor Donna fought such a valiant battle in there, you know, and to a standoff at the end. She got much of the material out, but not all of it, and not everybody finally was able to get that particular one. But I was really surprised myself that in a search for material on the Book of Job, I found an article printed in last June's Wall Street Journal, the last place I would have expected, you know, to find material of that caliber. But I thought particularly the article to this man who has written a book called The Book of the People, How to Read the Bible, the central idea that he had there with regard to the Book of Job, I thought was just really interesting, useful, helpful in our daily lives as well. So hopefully you'll find some time to be reading through that as well. As always, those of you that are regularly here are familiar with how I like to always start off with a geographical lesson, I guess. We've been focusing all day today, previous two classes, as well as what you see before you with the location of Caesarea Philippi. This next little series that I'm going to show you here are photographs I took myself in 2011. So if you were here, you saw the other photos from this morning. Now, this is the actual approach to the location of the old temples from Jesus' time and from that of the apostles there in what is largely dedicated to the idol Pan, but also to Augustus and then to Zeus. To the left, those are little dams, and there are several of them that they have, creating pools that there as you have one of the sources of the Jordan River. But as I was approaching there, I was walking down this pathway with everybody, looked up ahead here. These are people from our group. Not quite sure that might be Farrell Jenkins there. He had a white hat very like that one. But I was approaching this location, and I saw this man standing here, looking up at the end. It kind of caught my attention. And so I decided that I was going to go up and see what was fixating his attention. So I clambered up that hillside there, and I snapped this shot that's looking to the west along, it would be to the east, along that cliff face, and would have been looking down then on the structures from that first century time. Now, I spent an enormous amount of time online for a wide variety of reasons, looking for material, but also for photographs. And I don't believe I've ever seen a photograph like this one. For some reason, everybody just follows the path, I guess. They're on a tour or whatever. But I thought this was particularly useful, as you can see that there is a kind of an enclosure there with another hillside rising up on this side. So now that I was up looking on that side, I decided to have to go climb the other side. I ran across a little tour group with all looking at this, and got a picture looking back the other way. So that first picture was taken somewhere up in here, and then looking down from this side, you can see the opening to what they considered to be, at the time, the gates of Hades in their mythology of the time. And then, again, in this picture, which I particularly like, you can see how tall the cliff is now because you can see the top of it. And I'm thinking in this next trip, and by the way, this will be the first of what will probably be about 40,000 times I'm going to tell you this. I'm planning a third trip to Israel in June. So those of you that are anxious to do that, and by all means, come and see me. There are still spaces available there, but I am planning to spend myself a month in Israel come next June. And then there's a guided tour that I'll be starting off with that some of you would more likely be involved in instead of wandering around with me afterwards. But now, this is one of the sites that you surely will see, and it is just an awesome thing. This is what they were up against in the first century. These were the gods of their time. And when you see with your own eyes what are magnificently beautiful places, both naturally and then in the structures that were presented there, you can appreciate that their times, at least, were as difficult as ours, perhaps even more difficult than ours. And yet those first saints were determined that they were not going to allow the world to influence their lives. They would be separate from that world. They would be superior to that world. They would suffer the loss of all things, including their own lives and that of their families, if they must, in order to serve the one true and living God. And of course, if you were to insult or in any other way express, you know, your dissatisfaction with Roman or Greek gods of the time, then your life was very certainly quite tenuous, to say the least. Now, it's playing together into a larger scheme as we've been studying the book of Job on Wednesday nights that we want to think about that book again here this evening. This was not a place of human sacrifice at the time, but it was a place where you could get yourself in trouble and executed by the authorities, you know, somewhere else. But this was the actual location now, with their standing line, is where the temple itself would have stood, and backing up, you know, to the cave itself, the best photo I could get of it. But I want you to see the size of several of the idols themselves. These niches contain idols that would be about twice human size here, even larger in the other structures. And these niches also all contain on the pedestals the various idols being, you know, set forth for the public. And so they were constantly confronted with the omnipresence of these false gods in the great contest with the God of heaven. Now, turning our attention directly to Job, you may remember from a couple of weeks back, we had the reading in the early part of Job, that Eliphaz, one of his three friends, in chapter 5, verses 6 and 7, said that affliction does not come from the dust. It's not like the sufferings we have are grass growing up, you know, out of the ground. He said, nor does trouble sprout from the ground. So it's not a crop that you reap, you know, as a function of the earth there. But he then adds, for man is born for trouble as sparks fly upward. So his point, though, still was very kind of self-defeating, if you will, that you absolutely cannot escape it. Man is born for this. Sparks fly upward and not down. You know, that's the nature of the physics. And man is born for trouble. That's just the nature of the circumstances. But the question arises, brethren, you'll see this quotation, you know, very frequently. But most often, when it's quoted, you don't realize that it's out of the mouth of an uninspired friend of Job who came to criticize Job and whose argumentation is incorrect. Eliphaz is not inspired by God to tell us that statement is true. He is an uninspired man who is criticizing Job and trying to argue that if you're in trouble, Job, with all these afflictions that you've got, it's not like grass growing up out of the ground that you can't prevent. It is a thing that you've been involved in. You're born for trouble, and apparently you've been participating in it. What he's trying to say is like sparks fly up from the ground, you will be punished for your sins. All three of his friends are arguing that at length in the book of Job. You are suffering because it is the nature of the universe that you suffer when you sin. So this idea right here that so many cite as if it were God's wisdom and him trying to help us to understand this, you know, is really not the case. It's Eliphaz's idea. However, let me ask you, I mean, did a show of hands this morning, let's do it again. How many of you have never had any trouble in your life? Never had a problem? It's just easy street here, you know, bowls and cherries and all that. Well, you know, there's no such thing. And so you have to grant that while God did not put the words into Eliphaz's mouth, it certainly does seem to be the case that you cannot escape trouble. If you've been born in this earth, you are going to have trouble. So remember the context. He's criticizing unfairly Job. But he is stating a common experience in life. It seems to be utterly inescapable. And so, the question that they're debating, and the question that all mankind's been debating, no doubt a question you've wrestled with yourself, is why? Why is it that we suffer? So, we've been reading Job on Wednesday nights. We're going to be studying Job again this upcoming Wednesday night. It's going to be the last of 3 weeks that we've been looking at Job as we've been going chronologically through our study of the entire Bible. Let's tonight just list why it is that you might find yourself in trouble. Because most often when people ask that question, why, virtually whatever follows is going to be the same thing. When you say, why? There's generally that implication there, and the thought resides in your mind that it's not fair. Why does mankind suffer? As if he shouldn't be suffering, but he does. It always seems to kind of lurk in this why question. So this evening, I just thought it'd be wise for us to look through the inspired revelation of God, where we are given answers to the question, why is it that things go so horribly wrong and so very often? And we're going to start at the very beginning of beginnings then. None of these passages will be on the screen, so now you'll certainly need to open your Bibles now and come on to Genesis. You're going to have not a whole lot of verses here this evening, but enough to keep your fingers busy. And so going clear back to the very beginning in Genesis chapter 3 and verses 11 through 19. One of the longer passages we'll look at. Now, but I'm going to read straight through it. You're so very familiar with it. He said, God did to Adam and Eve, who told you that you were naked? Have you eaten from the tree of which I commanded you not to eat? And the man said, the woman thou gavest to be with me, she gave me from the tree, and I ate. Then the Lord God said to the woman, what is this you've done? And the woman said, the serpent deceived me, and I ate. Now before we go any farther, everything that's been said here so far is absolutely true. Adam was confronted by Eve, who had been deceived. Adam, we are told later in 1 Timothy, was not deceived, but Eve was. So, one is deceived and broke God's law, ate the fruit. The other is not deceived and broke the law and ate God's fruit. God now is going to issue his proclamations on the consequences and penalties for these two sins. So first, addressing though, the instigator of it all, in verse 14, the Lord God, that is Yahweh God, said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you more than all cattle, more than every beast of the field. On your belly shall you go, and dust shall you eat all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise you on the head, and you shall bruise him on the heel. I'm not going to get into all of the doctrinal, you know, discussion that's involved with that. Just see this serpent and Satan, later identified, certainly is being punished for his role in this. But the woman was deceived. She was deceived. Now, for most of us, we think that's a caveat that ought also to excuse. She was fooled. She was mistaken. She did not intend to do evil, but the serpent goaded her into it, tricked her into it. And that is the truth. But you'll note that she's still punished. In verse 16, to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply your pain in childbirth. In pain you shall bring forth children, yet your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And then to Adam, who was not deceived, but ate, he said, because you've listened to the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree about which I commanded you, saying you shall not eat from it, cursed is the ground because of you. In toil you shall eat of it all the days of your life, both thorns and thistles it shall grow for you. And you shall eat the plants of the field, by the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, because from it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Who's punished here? All three players. Satan, who is tempting to sin, the woman who is deceived, and the man who was not deceived, are all cursed. They are all condemned. That's three. What's the fourth that is cursed? Cursed is the earth because of you. This entrance into sin, of sin into the earth, brethren, changed everything. Now, no man knows. The Bible doesn't say, I don't know. But my guess is that what we, you know, so famously refer to as the second law of thermodynamics, that all things tend, you know, to decay. That fundamental rule of all physics, it's never been contradicted. It seems to just, you know, undergird so much of everything that we ever know in the physical world. The second law of thermodynamics, sometimes called that law of entropy, did not exist before the sin. So what I'm thinking is that earth originally was not decaying, did not need, you know, to be eventually obliterated. Adam and Eve certainly did not need to die prior to the sin, but they sinned. And whether deceived or not, they're punished for the sin. And that second law, that law of entropy, apparently, God then imposed upon His creation. And that is inescapable. That fact is the way the world works, because these two chose to sin. So what I'm saying is, got carried away there, is that in Genesis chapter 3, verses 11 through 19, we find out that a lot of people are going to suffer, that everybody is going to suffer. And it's the nature of the earth. Anybody that wants to eat is going to have to work for it. If you want to have a crop, you're going to have to toil in the soil to bring that thing forth. So, if you are suffering, it may be that you're just simply a part of a physical universe that now has that second law and many others in place. That's the way it works. So, just know that. My grandfather, long since deceased, long about 1991, I think he died somewhere in there, my grandfather had the most fascinating thumb. As small children, we just loved my grandpa's thumb, because my grandpa worked, not for Boeing, but down in California for Northrop, actually played a role in some of the design features of the great flying wing that you may remember from so long ago. But at any rate, they had a big pulley system, mechanized and chains in this environment where he was working, you know, heavy equipment and building this aircraft and all that, and he somehow managed to get his thumb wedged in one of those links. And they couldn't stop it. So what did it do? It tore the whole end of his thumb right off. Just popped it off. And then, as it healed, his thumbnail grew around right on the end exactly like a dog's claw. My grandpa had the most fascinating thumb. How'd he get it? That's the way the world works. That's just the way things function. And if you get out of sorts with the way the world turns, the way stuff physically works, you're in trouble. So, how should you feel about it? The only thing you can do is just accept it. That's the way the world works. Now we come to Numbers and the consequence of other people's sin in Numbers chapter 14. So don't have to turn too many pages there. Still in the book of Moses, of course. And in this 14th chapter, kind of lengthy reading, but we'll start in verse 28 here. Say to them, as I live, says Yahweh, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses shall fall in this wilderness, even all your numbered men, according to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Now this story is very long. It goes back to the preceding chapter, all of this chapter, clear up now to verse 30. It's going to continue on for some time, but you know the story. Spies went into the promised land. Spies came back. 10 gave a bad report. Big guys, well fortified. I don't think we could beat them. 2 men had faith and said, we can take them. God said we could. Let's go. So our promised land, you know, to have. Well, they wouldn't. They rebelled. Now look, though, particularly at verse 31. Your children, however, whom you said would become a prey, I will bring them in, and they shall know the land which you have rejected. Skip the corpses in 32 and now read 33. And your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they shall suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the wilderness. Now, brethren, for everybody that was 20 years old or younger, was it their fault that mommy and daddy pitched this hissy fit and decided to side with the 10 spies instead of Joshua and Caleb? That they would have to live the next 40 years? Think about it. They're younger than 20, at 19 and call it 20, 40 years. How old are they going to be when they enter the promised land? Well, I don't know about you, but I'd rather enter the promised land about age 23. Instead of 63. So, was this a good thing for them? No. Were they guilty of any crime? No. And sometimes, brethren, it's the way the world works. You get caught up in somebody else's crime. Donna, some years ago, stumbled across this forensics files program. We looked at one yesterday. They had about 645 of them at that time. Maybe they got 1,000 of them by now. You know, I don't know. But these things deal with actual events that took place, and then they interview all the people that participated, and you see, you know, these real crime dramas. So, when I woke up from this afternoon's nap, before I got out of my lazy boy, I looked on the TV, one of these things going on. Three FBI agents, you know, were driving cars in separate cars. And then another police officer, a sheriff, was coming the other way. And in a curve, the police officer crossed over the center lane, hit the second car, killed all three Secret Service agents that were in that car. So they had three cars, and then one of them, they had three guys, and they all died. And they're trying to figure out what happened. Why did this go down? It's all the sheriff's fault, you know, and so we're going to put him in jail. It's all his fault, and manslaughter and all the rest of it. Guess what turned out? Turned out that the first car in the FBI procession had crossed over the center line. And what the eyewitness, who was the fourth car of the train, couldn't see just around the corner, was that that poor sheriff had made a move to avoid it, had hit his brakes, caused him to skid. He was completely out of control when he crossed over the center line and killed those three guys. It would have never happened if the lead car had not been in his lane when it came around the corner. Okay, well, what do we find out? Three guys are dead, and it's not their fault. And they were killed by this other guy who crossed over the center line, but it wasn't his fault either. It was somebody else's fault. It was the driver of the car that was up ahead. Brethren, sometimes you will be caught in those circumstances, and there's nothing you can do about it. So accept it. Why does mankind suffer? That's the way the world works. Sometimes evil people do evil things, and you're going to wind up paying the price for it. Job chapter 1, we've studied so thoroughly, I'm just going to wave my hand at it. Why did Job suffer? Because God had an unknowable purpose. That man could not know what God was doing with him. What a test case that he was. That it was a credit that he had been such a righteous man that he now finds himself in this position. It's precisely because he's so righteous that God is allowing Satan to put him to the test like this, to prove that you and I could be so righteous and could suffer so well. Because Job sure enough did it in complete ignorance of what had brought it upon him and with no supernatural aid whatsoever. He went through those circumstances and never sinned against his God. So sometimes you may be suffering in a similar manner. And wouldn't we all like to think, it's not fair because I never sinned. You know, why am I sinning? Wouldn't we rather like to think that that's always the case and I'm suffering because God's looking down on me as such a perfect example, you know, of Christian manhood and womanhood that he's using me to show the world. Well, we know ourselves better than that most of the time, don't we? Okay? But it is one way that people can suffer. And when I look at some of those apostles and prophets, it appears to me that they were suffering in a similar manner. Certainly they hadn't deserved these things. Now, Matthew chapter 5 is one that is overlooked, I think, sometimes in this great question of suffering. And it is related to the Job event, but stands quite by itself as well. In the Sermon on the Mount, or early in that Sermon on the Mount, one of the very first things that Jesus wanted the Jews of his day to understand, and by extension for us as well, in chapter 5 and verse 10. Blessed are those who have been persecuted. Why? For the sake of righteousness. For theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men cast insults at you and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely on account of me. Rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you. Now, freely, I have to recognize this is not, you know, general suffering like a car accident, an illness, you know, something like that. This is persecution, the world turning against me, and so I'm facing the wrath of some person who's in opposition to truth, to righteousness. But nonetheless, it's suffering. And so what Jesus is telling you is, yeah, I expect this. And it is to your credit that you're getting the job done. And when you face this time, it shouldn't be with resignation and understanding and a shrug of the shoulders. That's how the world works. In this case, you are suffering for Christ's sake. Then rejoice. Things are going well. I can't stop it. And I should be glad that I am withstanding this test, well-pleasing in the sight of my God, getting the work done to such an extent that I am now reaping what I've sowed. Because, brethren, the world will always rebel against righteousness and truth, and often enough against wisdom in the face of their foolishness. Galatians chapter 6, a single verse this time. Galatians 6 and verse 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, this he will also reap. What is this reason for your suffering? You asked for it. Okay? Doesn't seem to cross people's mind. Why me? Why am I suffering? You know, that implication is always there. I don't deserve this. Yes, you do. And you may not even know why, but nonetheless, often enough, we are being punished for our personal sins. We are reaping what we sowed. We do deserve this. And now you don't just shrug your shoulders and say this is the way the world works. And you certainly shouldn't be glad and rejoicing that your name is written in heaven. What now? There's shame and the recognition, I have failed, I need to repent, I need to correct and not repeat. I've got to fix this thing. Now, in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, I save this one for the last because it's kind of my favorite one. And once again, people seem, you know, just not to recognize even that this is a possibility. But here's Solomon 3,000 years ago, telling us 1,000 B.C. in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. And sometimes, brethren, it's just this in verses 11 and 12. I again saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, and the battle is not to the warriors, and neither is bread to the wise, nor wealth to the discerning, nor favor to men of ability. For time and chance overtake them all. Moreover, man does not know his time. Like fish caught in a treacherous net, birds trapped in a snare, so the sons of men are ensnared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. What can overtake you in verse 11? You're in the wrong place at the wrong time. So brethren, it may be that it's just the curse of the earth. That's the way things work. It may be somebody else sinned, and unhappily you're paying the price for it. I couldn't even look at those pictures that were all over here the last few weeks. Apparently some grandparents somewhere overdosed on heroin. I think they died, and they had their grandchild in a car seat with them, and some state took pictures of this and put them all up there over everywhere, and I got just a glimpse of it. I thought, you know, I can't handle this. I don't even want to see this, and I just looked away. You know, it was a consequence of somebody else's sin, what was going on in those families. But sometimes it's God's own purpose, and you may never know about it. And sometimes it's because you're doing right, and sometimes it's because you're doing wrong, and sometimes it's got nothing to do with any of the above. You just... Sorry. You know, stuff happens, and when it does, you get caught up in it, then, well, sorry, but that's the way that the world works. Now, brethren, how much comfort did that bring you? Good for you. Went through this whole lengthy deal to show you, here's everything God says on the subject. You ought to be expecting it. There's different ways to respond to it. Sometimes it's your fault, sometimes it isn't. The world's been asking since Job's day and all of his friends, you know, why? God says, well, now you know. And how do you feel? Very unsatisfied. Like most folks, what? I still don't want to suffer, and it's not addressing my question anyway. That does not answer the personal question, why am I individually sinning? And why couldn't it have been some other way? And why does God allow it when often enough it is wholly unfair? And why can't I even know why? So often, I never know why. Why? I just want to know. I'm not complaining. I just would like to understand. How many of you remember these words? Raise your hand. Does that sound familiar? Does any man know where the love of God goes when the waves turn the minutes to hours? Gordon Lightfoot, 1976. Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Remember that song? Okay, really huge back in 1976. When he wrote it, the Canadian Gordon Lightfoot, what was he writing about? He was writing about the wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which was an ore ship with 29 sailors on board. They got caught up in a terrible storm that came down on the Great Lakes, and it sank, and they all died. Church bell chimes rang 29 times for each man on the Edmund Fitzgerald as the song comes to an end. Hey, well, why? Didn't God love them? Was it because they were all sinners? Does anyone know? Where did God's love go for them? Now, Gordon Lightfoot's farthest thing from a Christian. He's maybe criticizing God with that line as well, but it certainly represents the great overarching question. Why? God, you give me all these reasons that it might be, but you're not telling me which one that it is, and I still want to know. So, I would like now to have us look just quickly at a couple of passages, and we'll wrap this up, but I want you to see these passages. These passages, I think, are particularly fascinating because they give warnings that are, again, seemingly overlooked by the great majority of people who have some particular instance that takes place in their lives. They start asking this why question over and over again and thinking that it ought not to be this way. In Job chapter 11, this time from Zophar the Naamathite. So once again, an uninspired man speaks. He gives his own ideas, and he is not inspired to open his mouth. But in verses 7 and 8, he says this, "Can you discover the depths of God? Can you discover the limits of the Almighty? They are high as the heavens. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol. What can you do?" Now, brother, he certainly spoke the truth there, didn't he? And what is that truth? Who are you to question God? Friend, I guess it's a human experience universally. Why is all this happening to me or the people I love? Why is this happening? And I'm thinking so far here, he at least got this much right. You are demanding an answer from a God who is your creator and so superior to you in every way. Who do you think you are? Can you discover the depths of God? Can you discover the limits of the mighty, high as the heavens, and deeper than Sheol? What do you know to even dare to ask such a question? Well, how about this one over in Isaiah chapter 55? In Isaiah 55, verses 8 through 11, another simple statement of fact, but the consequences of it, the ramifications of it, are something we need to try to remember at all times in our lives. In Isaiah, in the 55th chapter, verses 8 and 9, and then 10 and 11, "My thoughts, God says, are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares Yahweh. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there without watering the earth, making it bear and sprout, furnishing seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be, which goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, without accomplishing what I desire, and without succeeding in the matter for which I sent it." Was Zophar right in Job 11? He absolutely was. Because Isaiah does speak for God and says exactly the same thing. What does he say? You better be mighty careful when you start second-guessing what's going on in your life, seeing that there's a God in heaven whose ways you cannot know. You are human. He is divine. Ecclesiastes chapter 8 again. Same chapter we looked at just a moment ago. But in this book of Ecclesiastes now, a little bit later, verses 16 and 17 of the last two verses, Solomon says, "When I gave my heart to know wisdom and to see the task which has been done on the earth, even though one should never sleep day or night, and I saw every work of God, I concluded that man cannot discover the work which has been done under the sun. Even though man should seek laboriously, he will not discover. Though the wise man should say, I know, he cannot discover." And finally, we won't even have to turn there, Deuteronomy 29:29 says this very simply, "The secret things belong to God and not to you." So the next time something happens, and the next time you're really hurting, and the next time it just makes no sense, and you're saying, why me? Know this, it's not a sin to ask that question. I'm not saying it's a sin. Did Jesus not ask that question? He did. Why hast thou forsaken me? It is not a sin to want to know. But be careful, brethren, because there is no need for you to know. You want to know. But if God sees no need for you to know, then you're not going to know. And often enough, it wouldn't be helpful even if you did. I'm out of time. I'm not going to delve into that right now. But it changes everything, brethren, when you have data as opposed to when you don't. So when you don't, then we discover the truth of this, which is not a Bible statement, but ours is not to reason why. Ours is what? I don't even know where that came from. I'll have to dig that one out sometime. But brethren, that is the human condition. It's not ours to question God. It's not ours to know all the answers. It's not up to us to be omniscient. His ways, His thoughts are higher than ours. Ours are too low. We wouldn't understand. Our responsibility is to live our lives properly. And it's inevitable, Hebrews 9:27, what happens in the end? You die. Now open up to the Hebrew letter. Since we had a very capable reading this evening in chapter 11 down through the end of chapter 11, I'm just going to start with chapter 12 where that reading broke off. We had a long list at the end of chapter 11 of terrible suffering, horrifying suffering that was going on. In chapter 12, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us. And let us run with" what? Endurance. Not knowledge, not divine understanding, not the answer to the question why. Run with endurance the race that is set before us. fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who has endured such hostility by sinners against himself, so that you may not grow weary and lose heart. Now the verse doesn't say, so you'll know why. It just says, look what he did, do the same thing, don't grow weary, don't lose heart. Verse 4, you've not yet resisted to the point of shedding blood in your striving against sin, and you've forgotten the exhortation which is addressed to you as sons. My son, do not regard lightly the discipline of the Lord, nor faint when you are reproved by him, for those whom the Lord loves, he disciplines, and he scourges every son whom he receives. It's for discipline that you endure. God deals with you as with sons. For what son is there whom his father does not discipline? If you're without discipline, you never have to ask the question, why? Because life's a bowl of cherries. Well, if you're without discipline, which all have become partakers, then you're illegitimate children and not sons. Where did all this start, brethren? Hebrews 11:1. What is faith? It is the not knowing why and persevering anyway. Did any of the people in that long list at the end of the chapter, in the middle of the chapter, or the beginning of the chapter have the answers to the why question? No, they didn't. The writer tells us they were never to receive what was promised. They died long before the Christ came, and they would never know in this life that God had something greater for you and for me, for Christians. That there was a marvelous plan that they couldn't possibly understand. They never knew it. But they are set as a great cloud of witnesses to encourage us. Can you lead a faithful life, well-pleasing in the sight of your God, and go to heaven and never know the answer to the question why? Yes. Because faith is the answer to all of your problems, not the answer to the question, why? That's the whole point of the life that we're living. So, don't mean to say the suffering is not terrible. I'm not trying to minimize it in any way. I'm just saying, it is not a sin to wonder. But be careful, brethren. Likely, you're never going to know. What God asks is that your faith just grow like oak trees, like sequoias, so that you, without the answers to the specific questions of your life, can serve your God and go home to spend an eternity with Him. Appreciate your attention. As always, we offer this opportunity for you to seek prayer, personal counseling, Bible study, if you're ready to become a Christian. You know what to do. Come speak with us. Let today be the day of salvation as we stand and sing.